Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Matthew Fitzsimmons. And Matthew is the author of a political thriller set in D.C., and we're recording this the week of the presidential election, so that's apropos. The title is Late. Now, Matthew, as an American boy from Illinois, grew up in London in the 1970s. For college, he attended Swarthmore College, where he earned a BA in psychology, but lived largely in and for the theater. After several years in New York City, and after having learned he wouldn't do absolutely anything to make it, he absconded to China, where he wrote his first novel, played center back for a foreigner soccer team, sparked a near riot, and had some other fun time. He now lives in Washington, D.C., where he taught English literature and theater at a private high school for over a decade. And he has written quite a few books, thrillers, and I think mostly, are they mostly political thrillers? Is that the genre?
I would say this is my first purely political thriller. This first series was set in and around Washington, had a political aspect, but I wouldn't call those hard and fast.
Okay. Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Matthew.
Thank you.
So what made you decide to write a political thriller?
I grew up in London until I was about 12, and then my family was transferred to Washington, and that's been a home base for most of my life. I went to college, I lived in New York, I lived in China, but D.C., I've never known where to say I'm from. Yeah, I was born outside of Chicago, but I left when I was three, so that doesn't really feel like home. I'm also not from. So anyway, so I've always had it in mind to write a political thriller. It's an interesting town, and anywhere where the stakes are this high, there's just natural drama. There's natural grist for the mill to tell these kinds of stories.
That's a very good point. I'm very curious, what took your family from Illinois to London to D.C.?
So my dad, as only a man who graduated from college in the 1960s, he graduated from college with a divinity degree, didn't know what to do with the divinity degree from Syracuse, and someone said, well, you should go into banking. Weren't you the treasurer? Weren't you the treasurer of your fraternity? And he said, I was the treasurer of my fraternity. So he applied for a job in banking based. So anyone who's under about 30, whose head is exploding right now, you're completely justified. So based on being the treasurer of a fraternity at Syracuse University, he got a job in banking in Chicago. And then one day when I was about three, they said, hey, Fitzsimmons, we need someone for the London branch. You pack your family, you're going. And he was about 26, I guess, 27 at the time, and they packed him off to London because American banks were investing in oil and gas in the North Sea at the time because of everything that was going on with OPEC and the oil embargo. And then my parents got divorced. My mom married a lawyer who was stationed in London with a firm, and the firm brought him to Washington. So it was this sort of fatherly ping pong game. So I moved to Washington with him. And that's how I came.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, it's interesting because I could have had a similar story.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. I was born in California. My family moved when I was three. My family moved in three to Pennsylvania, where I grew up, and then we moved to Iowa. But my father was actually in the CIA before I was born. Yeah. And he left because they wanted to post him to Saudi Arabia, and he already had one son, and he decided that wasn't the life for him. But he could have gone into the Foreign Service, and then who knows where we would have ended up.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was apparently on the Arab desk during the Suez Canal crisis.
Oh, that must have been fascinating.
Yeah. Now, he never talked about it, obviously.
Yeah.
But so that's really all I know. That and that his cover was Army, and he had supposedly he worked in the Pentagon, But his office in the Pentagon was a broom closet, and his real office was at Langley. So
Yeah,
that's all I
and
know.
it's funny in DC because no one actually says the word CIA. I have friends who work in Washington, and if they have to deal with the CIA, they say, I've got to go across the river. And if you say they work across the river, the only place that that means in Washington is you work, because it's crossing the Potomac south into Virginia. If you work across the river, it means you work at Langley. But you
Oh,
never say Langley,
interesting.
and you never say CIA. I never hear anyone refer to them directly. It's always this sort of effusive, or I've heard it referred to as our three-letter friends. Our three-letter friends in Virginia, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
It's, I sometimes wonder what my life would have been like if my dad had stayed in,
I think about that all the time. If I had just grown up in Wheaton, Illinois, and that is such a sliding doors moment. My entire life would have been just if
Very
some if
different.
John, you know, Fitzsimmons isn't the right guy for the London job, let's get O'Brien. Or apparently they only hire Irish guys in this imaginary bank I'm talking about. But I think everyone's got moments like that where things could have just gone wildly one way or another. But no, so I went to London, and it changed my life. It was transformative.
Did you get to spend some time in Ireland?
Not until much later. We don't have time on this podcast, but my dad, in later life, wound up marrying an Irish woman from Belfast, and he lives there now. So I spent
Oh,
quite a
wow.
bit of time in Ireland. But not until I was an adult. We didn't go over at all when I was a kid living there.
Wow. So China, what drew you to China? Sorry, I know we got to get into the book, but I'm just
No,
curious.
it's fine. I mean, I put the stories out there, and then I have to take responsibility for them. After college, I wanted to be in the theater. I went to New York. I wanted to be a director. I did not have the right stuff. I did not, as I think as I wrote, I said I wouldn't do absolutely anything to make it. And once I decided that, I sort of had the grand idea to be a writer, which was not a good decision. But I met a woman who we dated for about 6 months, and then she got a job at a university in China. And she said, "Do you want to come?" And I was 24, and I went, "Sure. I'll go to China." So I went to China, and I wrote there for 2 years, and wound up actually teaching theater at the University of Nanjing. But I had no good reason to be there. It was just one of those impulsive things you do when you're a kid, and you didn't know. I didn't know what else. I knew I wanted to be in the arts, and I didn't know how to get into the arts, and so I ran away to China, where I didn't have to explain myself to anyone.
Could you even speak to anyone?
No. It is such a complex language, and the woman I was seeing, we had to pretend to be man and wife. We had to buy wedding rings in Hong Kong before we flew into the People's Republic, so that we could appear to be married, so that we could live together in sin. And she spoke very good Chinese. And so I just rode her coattails. I could say a handful of things, but I was like, I'm never like this language is beyond me. There's just no. If you like English and you want to learn Spanish, the grammar is the same, the syntax is the same. You can even recognize words. Chinese, there's just
No
no
connection.
correlation. No.
I know a couple words. Ni hao.
There you go. And that's one I still remember.
Yeah, but it's you're right, it's tough. So you said you decided to be a writer and that was a bad idea, but here you are all these years later as a writer. So when did it become a good idea?
It did. It took longer than I wanted. I wrote a novel in my 20s. I tried to write the Great American Novel. It was neither of those things, as it turned out.
Great or American?
Not particularly great, not particularly American. And I quit. By the time I was done, I was in my late 20s. I had nothing salable to show for it. And I was like, oh, I need to actually have a living. That's the hard thing about the arts is if you miss, you can't put it on your resume. Like you can't put, I wrote a book that no one would buy on your resume and have people go, you're the guy we want. We want to hire you.
Not like having a divinity degree to become a banker.
The 60s were a glorious time, apparently.
Well, for a white man.
Yeah, you know, and my dad is decidedly a white man. hi, Dad. Yeah, so I took 15 years off, taught English at a high school, and then secretly wrote my first novel because I didn't want anyone to know, because I felt like I'd embarrassed myself the first time, and you kind of don't want to go back and tell people, hey, remember that novel I wrote in my 20s that didn't go anywhere? Well, I'm doing that again. So it was kind of a top secret project of mine until it was done.
So were you writing like nights and weekends or?
Nights, weekends, nice thing about being a high school teacher is you get the summers off.
So, yes.
So I did the bulk of it. It took me 2 years to write it. And I did the bulk of the writing over two summers.
And was that book, did that book get published?
Yes, that was the book that became The Short Drop, which was my first published book.
And that was in the Gibson Vaughn series?
That was the Gibson Vaughn series, yeah.
Okay, so who's Gibson Vaughn?
So Gibson Vaughn was, I guess still is, and I didn't kill him. He was a 28-year-old. I had a conversation. I started writing a thriller without really knowing who the guy I was writing, and I had drinks with a fellow who was in the information security business. And he started telling me about hacking and how, this was 10 years ago, and how hacking worked and how social engineering worked. And it sounded to me like a con man. And I went, wait, so hacking is really con artistry? And he said, oh yeah. He said, forget all like the scripts and the whatnot. Most of it is getting someone to click on their computer when they shouldn't. And most of that is conning them into thinking that it's either phishing or it's one of multiple cons over a computer. And I went, oh, that's it. So Gibson Vaughn is a ex-military hacker. And
good guy or a bad guy?
He's a good guy. He's a good guy. A redemption story.
Okay.
I wrote five books about him.
Wow. Okay. And then you wrote another series, the Constance series.
That's just I don't even think of that as a series. I sort of think of it as a two-parter, like a duology.
Okay.
That is a thriller with a science fiction piece. I basically had an idea one evening. Well, actually, one morning, I said, "How could I get someone to investigate their own murder?" And I tried to think of examples, and I could think of supernatural examples, like say Patrick Swayze in Ghost. I was like, "Okay, there's a guy who's investigating his own murder. But what if you're still alive?" And there's an old, I think Fred McMurtry movie from the 50s called DOA, where someone's poisoned, knows they've got poisoned, and they know they've got X amount of time. And they have to solve their murder before the poison takes them. And then it got remade with Dennis Quaid in the 80s or 90s. And I said, okay, but he's still alive. I want someone who's dead, actually dead, and investigating their own murder. And I couldn't think of it. I couldn't come up with a way to make that happen. And then I went, well, what if it was a clone? What if it was a clone of the person investigating the murder of their original? The original version of them. And I sort of sat bolt upright in bed and was like, Yahtzee. And it was like 12:30 in the morning. I just got in bed, finally came up with the answer. And I got up and wrote the first 40 pages. I was writing another book at the time, but that's basically what it's about. It's about set about 20 years in the future with sort of commercial cloning and the story of a woman who, a clone who has to figure out why she was killed.
Wow. So, are you a fast writer? You said you wrote like 40 pages, like.
When I've got the juice, for lack of a better term, I know that I just gave myself away as a child of the 80s. But like when I'm feeling it, I can write very fast. Normally I'm more measured and it's more of a process. But when I see it clearly and I really saw it clearly that night, I can really go.
So, in general, when you're writing, do you edit as you go, or do you get it all down the paper and then go back and do the editing as a separate process?
It's interesting. So after every book I believe, right? Like, I believe there's talent involved with being a writer, but having taught writing for 10 years, I also really believe that writing is a craft and a skill and something that you can get better at. And so after every book, I stop and I do sort of an after action report. And I decide to try and analyze, what did you do right? What did you do wrong? What should you be doing differently? And, so my writing process has changed dramatically over the last decade or so. I mean, when I started, when I first was able to quit my day job and write full time, I wrote from 7 in the morning until 6 o'clock at night, all day, 7 days a week. Like once you get the thing that you always wanted, you're so afraid of people taking it away from you. And I did that for a couple of books, and then I realized that I was burning myself out and that I was much less productive in the afternoon. And so I was like, no, you're only going to work from here into here, and then you need to do some other things. You need to diversify, and you can't work 7 days a week. It's just not healthy.
Right.
But to answer your like question, I tried it. When I first started, I was a terrible editor as I go. And that slowed me down oftentimes, and it prevented me from, I wouldn't write until I had the perfect answer rather than writing and then going back and looking at it later. And then at some point I had to cut 20,000 words out of a manuscript that I had edited as I go that were kind of like perfect, but no longer fit the story. And I went, how much time did you waste polishing this 20,000 words that you discovered as you that later on you didn't need? And so I have really tried to, that was one of my, stop doing that. Right. I'll do a light editing. I'll go back and look at things, but I try to like, let's just go. Like edit, let's edit after you can see get your arms around the whole thing rather than edit when you've only got this much of it to look at. And I think that's making me a better writer. It's making me a less crazy writer. So
That's a good thing.
that's a
For
positive.
me, I find editing is sort of easier because you've got it there to work with, and you're not having to
So
dig.
you and I are on the same page. Editing is so much more fun. I don't know how people edited before computers. I think about like William
I
Shakespeare.
do.
Yeah.
I have the legal pads with the cross outs and the arrows and the and this goes here.
I'm so lazy. I'm so inured to ooh, copy, paste, shift, boom. I like the
Oh, I
ability to
know.
just to manipulate words
But it's
now.
interesting, even though it's so much easier, do you think writing is better? There's a lot of pretty lousy writing getting out there these days.
So, it's an interesting. I don't know whether it's better. This is what I would is go back and look at the top 10 list from 1924. And there's not a top 10 selling books in the United States in 1924. I'm picking that at random. I bet you've never heard of any of them. Like, it's not the books that you want it to be. It's not the books
You
that
don't think
are. Ooh,
Hemingway, Fitzgerald, you don't think they're on there?
maybe here and there, but no, by and large, it's people, in the same way that if you ask someone who's reading now who Clive Cussler is,
They
and who
don't
is a
know.
hugely prolific, I bet you couldn't find a 30-year-old in America who knew who Clive Cussler is right this minute.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, may I that that. I think and that's not to say Clive Cussler's a bad writer, but I think, what we think of as there's so few books that transcend their particular
Time.
historical Most of them, my point is, like, there is bad writing at any time.
You've got, and that's a good point. That's a good point.
We look at it with rose-colored glasses because the books that have lasted have lasted because they are totemic and mammoth and important works. But in there's plenty of, like, you know, cheap paperbacks and bad writing and whatnot. In a weird way, I would say that writing has gotten better. You want to hear my theory on this?
Yes, I do. I do.
Okay. So I think writing got better after the advent of radio, TV, and movies. Because before radio, TV, and movies, books were the only game in town.
Okay.
And when you bought a book, you bought it as a commitment to, like, this is my evening entertainment for the next however long. So they wanted them long. Mm. And you go back and you read books from the night, a lot of the books from the 19th century, they are, you're
slow.
Like, you're coming along, and then there's 25 pages of describing this mansion and the furniture and the tapestries and the, because you couldn't go there yourself. So it's sort of, books served as a travel guide, as a documentary, as a window into a world you can't get to. And so writers were encouraged to be immensely verbose. And then TV, movies, et cetera, came along, and all of a sudden books had to compete for people's attentions. And lo and behold, the editor went, you know what? We don't need those 25 pages of
description.
You know,
yeah.
Of description.
Yeah.
And so, and again, I'm sure there are people who are like, no, I really miss, give me 30 pages about, you know, what the, you know, what the looks like. But for me, that sort of necessary, tightening the screw has been good for writing. But
now, you know, your books, as because of their thrillers, they're very plot driven, also character driven, but you know, there's plot is really important. Do you plot them out before you start writing?
So, you know, you have that, the everyone sort of asks that question about whether, you know, are you a plotter or a pantser?
Yeah.
Don't know, like, pantser is like writing by the seat of your pants. Are you making it up as you go, or are you, you know, I know people who storyboard the whole thing with an inch of its life before writing the first word. I think of myself sort of in the middle. I call myself a road tripper in that I know where I'm starting from and I know where I'm going. I know where the ending is, and I have the highways that I'm going to take. But if, as I'm on those highways, I see an exit sign that says, biggest ball of yarn in North America, I'm getting off the highway. I'm like, oh, we got to go see what's over there. And so I give myself the latitude to detour. There are no balls of yarn anywhere in my book. That was a metaphor. I want to be really clear. But yeah.
You don't give 25 pages describing a big ball of yarn. That's good to know. All right. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of The Slate. So let's talk about The Slate.
All right.
Where did this lead character come from?
So when I was growing up, there weren't – so the lead character's his name is Agatha. And when I was growing up, all the leads of stories were men. And if a woman was a lead in movies or TV, they were a spouse or a wife or a supporting character. And so, like, actresses, I always think of this in terms of movies because I love movies. But so if you were an actress in the 80s, you had a career from about the age of 22 to 33, and then you disappeared. And you didn't act again until you were a grandmother. And in Hollywood, a grandmother was 55. But like, there were just no women between those two ages. Like, there were no career for them. And one of the neat things to watch happening is to watch that change. Is that, you know, I remember watching a show called Mare of Easttown on HBO a while back. And the lead in that is Kate Winslet, who I grew up with and is now in her 50s. And you didn't have detective shows where the lead was a woman in her 50s. That just yeah. wasn't. And all
or
of a
Jodie
sudden,
Foster in True Detective.
Right. And yeah. now there is appetite for it. There is the sort of like those doors have been widened considerably. And who can be the lead of a thriller has changed. And I thought to myself that I'd seen, you know, I'd seen plenty of men in stories like this, and I was tired of it. And I would, so I very early on, I was like, I know I want, I could see Agatha. I know women like Agatha in Washington, D.C., you know, smart, capable, shrewd political operators who do the heavy lifting, who know how to get things done.
And know where the bodies are buried.
And I know where the metaphorical bodies are buried. And I like that, you know, they that was sort of my inspiration for the character was, you know, women that I actually know here in DC, and I know the jobs that they do, and I know how dedicated they are to what they do. They are not at like, to be fair to them, they are not Agatha, but that, so that's where that came from. Was that
how, you know, you're teaching high school in DC, how do you connect with these political operatives? Is that common to have that kind of, to be able to have that kind of connection?
Growing up, you know, it's an interesting town. I mean, no, I would not say that as a high school teacher, I was going to a lot of parties filled with political operatives. But having grown up here, I just, you know, you just, this is my, this is, you know, so many, I'm one of the few people I know who have never worked in politics here. You know, in some way or another, you know, whether it's nonprofit work or, although that's changed a lot, that's actually an unfair description. Like DC is now a much more diverse town in terms of who works here. There are many more businesses here. But growing up, DC was really a small, quiet, southern political town. And there was no reason for it to be here other than government. And that all changed in the late 90s as various things started to happen. And DC sort of gone through this massive evolution from about 95 until now. And just, you know, you meet people, you meet interesting people. And a lot of this has happened in the last 10 years since I've been a writer. I'm much more interesting now that I'm a writer than I was when I was a high school teacher.
I can see that. Yeah. I got to admit that when I was reading the slate at first, I was picturing Agatha kind of as Kerry Washington, from
Scandal. That's a good comp. Yeah. I mean, I think I think Scandal, there is some DNA of Scandal in this, a little House of Cards, a little of this, a little of that. It's interesting the ways that DC gets portrayed. And so rarely does it, as in most things, Hollywood almost never gets portrayed realistically. DC, you know, I went back and watched read and watched a lot of DC stuff. And it's just never accurate. It's just not, it's not how the town actually works. And so it's fun to be both an insider and outsider here. Like I don't work in the town, but the town is in my blood. Like it's in my home for most of my life. So.
And you're obviously not a woman. And I have, other times, when I've read books written by men with a leading female character, I sometimes get very annoyed at the way they get things wrong. And I didn't ever feel that in your book. So how were you able to do that? How were you able to write from the point of view of a woman having never been one in this lifetime?
Well, first of all, that's high praise. I mean, that's my number. So Constance, the book from the Constance series, that was also a female lead. It's nice of you to say that I got it right and that I didn't annoy you. And it is, because and that's one of your primary concerns. If you're going to write sort of someone who doesn't look exactly like, I mean, when I wrote Gibson Vaughn, who was 28, I was in my 40s. And I went and I found 28-year-olds to talk to. And I made sure my readers were of that age group. I mean, I think anytime you're sort of stepping away from who you are, you've got to do the work. I don't know how I did it. If you say that I did it, I feel really like happy to hear that. I think one of the things that I did was I showed it to women that I trust. And yeah. If I say something stupid, if I get something wrong, if something sticks in your ear or sticks in your craw, I want to hear it from you. I don't want to hear it from readers. So you can't hurt my feelings. You protect me. Like, help me not be an idiot. And so here's a story that I think got me started on this. So one night when I'm 6.5 feet tall. You can't tell from me sitting down, but I'm 6.5 feet tall. I'm a very large human, a large human man. And one night I'm about 20 something years old, and I come out of a bar with two women. And one of the women is meeting her boyfriend, who's like picking her up. And the other one lives within walking distance, and I live sort of the other way. And we say goodnight, and the woman gets in her car, and I walk home, and the third woman walks home. And the woman who got in the car with her boyfriend like called me the next day. She's like, "What is wrong with you?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Why didn't you walk her home?" Well, why would I walk her home? She lives like three blocks away. She's like, "Dude," I remember, she's like, "Dude." I was like, "What?" And I'm like, "You are so oblivious. You are so big, and you're such a, like, you just, like, she is 5'1", walking home three blocks. Are you out of your mind?" And I went, "Apparently." And I sort of thought about it. I had never thought about it. I was so, like, I just assumed that everyone wandered through the world as easily and without obstacle as I did. Because until, I think we get too into our own skin. And it was a really, I remember that, a point to that as like being a moment where I was like, well, I need to start thinking about how the world is for other people. Mm. And I think that's part about being a writer is if you're going to write someone, it's like, what's it like to be in their skin? Because if I wrote everyone like they were 6.5 feet tall, that would be a really weird book, because it's really weird being 6.5 feet tall. It comes with, it's not all it's cracked up to be. Like, it's so I think, it's like that sincere effort to just say, what is another person's experience? And that's the fun part. When I decided to write Constance and write it as a woman, someone's like, "Why? You're just making it harder for yourself." And I said, "Well, like, yes, but if you want to be a good writer, like, if you actually want to do the work, you can't just write yourself over and over and over again."
Good point.
Like, how are you growing? So
tell us what the slate is about. What's the kind of this main storyline?
So Agatha is a, let us say, a ethically gray area individual who is comfortable crossing lines and it has a sort of moral relativism that any good fixer, and she sort of comes from that literary tradition of the fixer, who the ends justify the means. And she, because she's good at that, because she's smart and because she will cross lines, she finds work with people who need her to cross lines. And so the book sort of, inciting incident is one night in 2001, her boss calls her and says, "Something bad has happened out at a hotel in Virginia, and I need you to go clean it up." And she does. And she crosses a bunch of lines, and she finally finds the line that is too much for her. But rather than fix it, she quits. And so basically her career ends at 30, and she turns her back on what she did. And as you know, I'm not reinventing the wheel here. The book takes place in present day or close to present day. 20 years later, she gets pulled back in. Now she's older, still hasn't really resolved what she did. And so it's a book about sort of a fixer who doesn't feel good about fixing things, but has to.
But this time, maybe on the side of right instead of the side of wrong.
That's, you know, so it's a redemption story. It's a coming to grips with what you're willing to do in the name of your career. I think, you know, it's a heightened story, but I think we all have moments in careers where someone asks you to. I had a moment when I was working in the theater in New York. I was working for a guy, I won't mention his name, but he was a theater producer and writer, and he gave me several hundred dollars in cash, and he sent me downtown to buy drugs for him, like a lot of drugs. And I was 23, and I really wanted to be in the theater, and he could make that happen. And like, if I had been caught with what I wound up going and buying and bringing back, I would have gone to jail. I would have gone to jail for a long time.
Wow.
And I took it, and without even, and it's one of the reasons I left New York. I took the money, I got in the cab with my backpack, I went down to this woman's apartment. She was a photographer, but apparently she also dealt on the side. And I bought it, and it was like a lot. And I put it in my backpack, and I went back, and I gave it to him. And I just did it without even thinking. I wanted it so badly. I wanted, and I think we have those moments. And that's a dramatic example. But I think we're always like, well, I'll step this close to the edge of my line. I'll step this close to my line. And Agatha stepped over the line.
Now, as a successful writer, do you still want to be in theater? Have you ever thought about writing plays?
I have. And I think that yes, I have all sorts of dreams about what I could be doing. At the end of the day, this is a job, and I need to support my family. And it's an interesting moment, like art and commerce, is that I worked really hard to create a career in writing that I could support myself in. And there are other things that I would like to do, but I do feel that you feel that like, oh, I could do this fun little side project, or I can do the thing that will keep me employed.
Keep the roof over the head.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think I probably become a little risk averse over time, where it's like I know where my bread is buttered and how it's buttered, and I like the work and I like writing. Like theater, like writing plays, that sounds like a lovely idea, but how am I going to do that? And look my 10-year-old in the eyes and be like, so about those new clothes you need, I'm writing plays now. It's a tough, it's a tough conversation to have with a 10-year-old. So
Yeah. So Matthew, why don't you read a little bit from the slate for us?
All right, be happy to. I'm just going to start from the top. I'm not going to confuse anyone with where we are in the story.
Okay.
And why don't you just cut me off when you've had enough of me?
All right. Sounds good.
Hold on. Let me just find my page. All right. I'm going to have to put my reading glasses on for this, so bear with me. January the 13th, 2001. Her phone rang shortly before midnight, or more accurately, one of them rang. She'd fallen asleep fully clothed, sitting upright in bed with a stack of Washington Post she hadn't gotten around to this week. On the television, David Letterman was interviewing Vince Vaughn about his new movie. Without opening her eyes, she muted the volume with a clicker and reached for the cordless on her nightstand. "Yeah," she said, stifling a yawn. "Agatha," Paul Paxton stated as if she were an amnesiac needing a reminder. "I wake you." She appreciated the congressman's feigned concern, but it was Friday night and that was personal. "What do you need, boss?" "There's been an incident out at the Gray Horse in Middleburg." Middleburg was a quaint little town in Virginia with a scenic main street boasting shops and a restaurant where a certain segment of D.C. went antiquing on the weekends. The Gray Horse was a historic inn that had been a fixture there since the 18th century. It wasn't the kind of place that had incidents. "Who?" she asked. "Clark." Agatha's eyes were open now. Clark would be Congressman Harrison Clark of the great state of Illinois. Is he alone? Of course not. Congressman Clark's wandering eye had always been his Achilles heel. That he was having a tryst hardly warranted a midnight phone call, though. "So what happened?" she asked. "There were drugs involved. Apparently they were having a little party. She overdosed." Paxton sounded almost excited, but it wouldn't be until much later that she stopped to contemplate what that meant. "Who's the girl?" Agatha asked, although she already knew the answer. "Yes," he said. Agatha let out a breath she didn't know she'd been holding and looked away to Letterman, laughing silently, head back like a man possessed. Charlotte Haynes was dead. Dead. That was a lot to take in, and Agatha didn't know how to feel about it. "Is that going to be a problem?" Paxton asked, mistaking her silence for reticence. "Just tell me what I need to do." She swung her feet off the bed and reached for a notepad. "That's why you're my killer." He meant it as a compliment, but she would always wonder about what it said about her that she took it as one. "Why didn't Clark call his own people?" "Oh, you know his chief of staff. The man's a damn Boy Scout. He'll overlook the infidelities, but this was falls far too outside his comfort zone." Paxton carried on laying it all out, while Agatha wrote everything down in her neat economical script, making notes to herself as she went. In the top left corner, she wrote "coffee" in all caps and underlined it three times. "So what's our play?" she asked. "Be a knight in shining armor. Clean up his mess." Neither said anything for a long moment, as if both knew a bright, uncrossable line was being crossed. They played plenty dirty, but always just this side of legal. Helping Clark with his predicament was a whole other proposition. Right now, no crime had been committed. A young Hill staffer overdosing in a congressman's hotel room wasn't great, but it was only a career-ending scandal. What they were discussing now was a criminal conspiracy. "Speak your mind," he said. "Are we sure we want to do this?" "I don't like it any more than you do, but this town is built on quid pro quo, and this is the mother of all favors. We do this for Clark, and I'm on the fast track, that much closer to accomplishing everything we came to Washington to do." It wasn't wrong. Clark was his party's whip in the House, and his opinion carried weight. That was why Paxton had targeted him in the first place. If Agatha did this, the congressman would be in their back pocket. What might have taken years of network and maneuvering could be done in the blink of an eye. Paul would jump to the front of the freshman class, choice of committee assignments, a voice in the party. Paxton could write his own ticket. She told herself it was worth the risk. "I'll get it done," she said. "I knew I could count on you," he said. "And Agatha, get pictures. You understand?" "On it," she said. "Good. How soon can you be there? I need to let the congressman know. He's understandably anxious." "At least an hour, probably two. I'll have to round up Darius." "Is it wise bringing someone else into this?" "I can't move a body and take pictures." Right, okay. "Is there anything else?" she asked, itching to get moving. She had a little over 6 hours of darkness remaining, and sunrise would not be her friend today. "No, call me when it's done. It'll be late." "I won't be asleep," he said, and hung up. Agatha set aside the cordless and reached into the bag at her feet for one of the three Nokia cell phones she carried everywhere. She'd need to destroy it after tonight. "What up, eh?" Darius said when he finally answered on the fifth ring. It was loud wherever he was, and the music all but drowned him out. She felt a little jealous. There had been a time in her life when she would have been the one out on a Friday night. "I've got a job. You want it?" she asked, kneeling to slip on her shoes. "That depends on what it is." Does it? She asked. Oh, it's like that. It's definitely like that.
Okay, that's a good stopping point, I think.
All right.
All right. So that is, yeah. You've definitely got the thing down where you grab the reader right away.
Thank you.
Did that, was this your initial starting point?
Yes. Yeah. This was, I had a lot of fun going back. Like, I know the exact date that it takes place on it. One of the fun things was finding out who was on David Letterman that night. And as the web provides, there's a list of every guest on every episode of David Letterman, if you know.
Seriously. Oh my gosh. So you actually go to that level of detail in researching.
I hate when I get emails from people who are like, actually, I have a mistake in my first book where I describe a scotch incorrectly.
How can you describe a scotch incorrectly?
So, broadly speaking, there are scotches that are peaty and scotches that are not. And if you drink scotch, the taste is quite distinct. And I described a scotch as being peaty, and I got an email from some, and a scotch that I've had. I don't know how I made the mistake. I know better. And the word got in there, and it never got corrected. And you stop seeing your own writing after a point. And I got an email from a guy who was like, really liked the book, but that scotch is not peaty. And I was like, and it bothered me ever since. So I like to get as best I can, and you're never 100%, but I like to get the Vince Vaughns and the David Lettermans of the world correct if I can.
I just don't quite understand why somebody would bother to email you about something like that.
I take it as the highest compliment that if you can write. I got a 1-star review on my first book on Amazon. I assume it's still there. And it was brutal. I mean, your book was generally really well reviewed, and it was the first 1-star review on the book. And I was reading them when I was just sort of fascinated by the whole process. So I was reading the Amazon reviews as they came in, and this review was just so mean and so harsh. And someone was like, and I told it to someone, and they're like, ow. And I said, yeah, but stop and think about it. Something I wrote made someone so angry that they stopped what they were doing to write me, to tell me. Someone I don't know and will never meet, but they're like, that guy needs to know how his book made me feel. That's awesome. So I like anytime someone is, you know, if you could get good reaction, no one likes everything. You know, that's a thing you have to remind yourself. And if you can get a reaction out of someone, you did something right, even if it made them angry, I guess.
That's a good point. Do you still read the reviews?
I do to a point. I found so I have what I would call a wisdom of crowds attitude about reviews. Any one review, whether it's on Goodreads or Amazon, doesn't mean anything. Like if someone says, oh, I really liked this, great, that person really liked that. If I see 50 of the 100 first reviews all say the same thing, now I'm like, okay, what is it about that thing that struck this group of people? And the converse is true. If 50 out of 100 people are like, I hated the Vince Vaughn thing. Why is Vince Vaughn in this? Took me out of the story completely. I hated that. If 50 out of 100 people said, I'd be like, okay, why? Why? What's going on there? And so at some point I stopped reading, but I do like to sort of take the first couple hundred and look at them for patterns or, you know.
And you learn from them and maybe change things in the future?
I have for sure.
So how, when you wrote that first book, which was your second book that you wrote, but the first one that got published, how did you find the publisher? What was your path to publication?
So I don't like to tell the story because I had the most charmed. I told this story at a conference once. I was having drinks with a group of other authors, and they're like, how did you meet your agent? And I told them the story, and someone leaned across and was like, don't ever tell that story. that story just—it's just going to make people mad. So the traditional path of finding an agent is you write a query letter, and you submit to agents and so forth and so on. And it can be—it's a lot of people say it's the worst part of the process. Getting published is not as hard as finding an agent, and that's really like the barrier and the gatekeeping part of the experience. And I know people who sent 100 query letters and took forever. I finished the book, and I was in the process of writing my query letter and coming up with my list of agents I wanted to submit to. And a friend of mine called and said, "Hey, I know an agent. I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. I think he reps your kind of book. Can I pitch it to him?" And I went, "What? sure. And she did. And he called me a week later. And he said, "First of all, your friend is a lot." I thought it was having a courtesy lunch. And also, she's pitching me this guy's book. But he liked it. And he's like, We've been working together ever since, and he turned out to be, he's a good friend of mine, phenomenal guy, and I got as lucky as a human being can get. I every day I am thankful for that, just this random happenstance.
You're right. That's a terrible story.
I shouldn't have told it. Now it's going to be out there, but it's the truth. The important thing is how much luck is involved with publishing, and that it's not just about, you know, writing a great book. Like, it also takes access and luck and timing and
persistence sometimes.
But
I do believe that quality of writing will win out in the end.
I think so too. I also think I saw a guy give an interesting talk once that sort of changed my mind on that. And he said there are about 10 different things that a writer can do to get an audience. And I, at the time, I was kind of a book snob, and I was like, well, the writing. It's about the writing. And he said, and he could hear my thoughts. He's like, it's partly about the writing. And he said, people read for different reasons, and that's okay. He said, some people read for the plot. Some people read for character. Some people read for the words. Some people read for a particular feeling that they want. And not every writer is good at all of them. In fact, most writers are only good at two or three of them. And we sort of scoffed at that because we're a room full of writers. He said, "Oh, no, let's play this game." And he said, "So pick a writer. Who's your favorite writer?" And someone shouted out a name. And they shouted out a writer that I really like, a guy named, he shouted out a name that we're all like, "Oh, he's a great writer." And he went, "Okay. Is he good with words?" "Yes." "Is he good with character?" "Oh, no." "Is he good with ideas?" "Oh, yes." "Is he good with plot?" "No." "Is he, you know," and he's good at about three of them. "Now let's do another one." And we went through about 20 authors, and each one of them, of the list of 10 things that someone might read for, was good at about three of them and was really good at those three. And then, but the others were, you know, those other qualities weren't necessarily their strong suit. That sort of humbled me a lot and made me more respectful of different kinds of writing. And that, in the same way that we listen to different kinds of music for different kinds of feelings, like sometimes you want Bob Dylan, you want to listen to the words, and sometimes you want James Brown and you just want to listen to the instruments. You know, James Brown's never going to win awards for his lyrics, but he's one of the greats. He's not a particularly good lyricist, and James Brown and Bob Dylan, not a particularly good singer. You know, we consume art for different reasons, and we go to people with different skill sets and different talents, and it's not just all you're a great musician at everything or you're a great writer at everything.
Do you have that list of 10 things?
I don't. I mean, but it's, if you start to do it and start to thinking about it, you know, it's like theme and idea, plot, character, relationships, the story. That's six. There were others. I'm not thinking of them off the top of my head, but and the whole thing came from a. Well, never mind. He explained how he came to the idea of this talk, which was he was talking to a friend of his who was a bassist, a professional bassist. And the guy said, well, there are about 10 things a bassist can do to be really good, and I'm good at three of them. And he said, so when you're practicing, do you spend your time practicing the other seven to get better at those? And he said, no, I spend all my time being the best at those three.
Oh, interesting.
And that was kind of, oh, interesting. And that said, no one.
Yeah.
So they're
well, Matthew, we're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sorry, too.
Just ran away.
It was such a pleasure to have you today, Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of The Slate. And we always close with a quote. And so I'm going to take the quote you put at the beginning of your book from P.J. O'Rourke. Whenever people tell you they are going to wipe the slate clean, it's your slate they mean to wipe. So thank you.
Thank you.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.